This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Nadia Aziz. You're listening to the fourth episode in our new series on heritage and culture and all things Malaysian. Today we journey through time almost six decades ago to take a behind-the-scenes look at a little-known part of the monarchy's history. Azif Azuddin has the story.
So you're outside for dinner and you're about to pay for your meal. You're standing at the counter, reaching for your wallet. You pull out some colourful polyester notes and hand it to the cashier. And you notice this face, a wise-looking old man with a moustache staring back at you. The tengkolok standing high on his head, regal, formal, and sober. Who is this guy? And what is he doing on your ringgit? Well, my friends, that's our first Young Dip Tuan Agong, Tuanku Abdul Rahman. I'm Azif Azuddin, and this week we'll be speaking to Razak Baharum from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club to learn about how we appointed our first Young Dip Tuan Agong and the birth of a new royal tradition. The post of the Agong was not always there. Before independence in 1957, the Malay rulers were held together loosely by a council of rulers.
Before independence, if you go way back, each state or each Malay state were headed by their respective sultans or rajas. Everybody were, they were more or less on their own, and there was no concept of a consolidated country, so to speak. Right after the war, the British tried to consolidate the powers of all these various sultans, rajas, and governors, and trying to form what they call the Malayan Union. And at that time, it was right after the war, there was a lot of mayhem, there was a lot of havoc within the states. There was even change of sultans, because in some states, the Japanese military changed the sultan. And when the British came back, they reverted back to the old sultans. So there was a lot of commotion.
Mm-hmm. And before we move on to the limited powers and a bit after the Malayan Union, what exactly were the responsibilities and the roles or perhaps the power that the sultans had before signing it off?
Well, before signing the Malayan Union and before the war, they had the last say in anything that goes on within their states. So it was quite an absolute power, so to speak.
I understand there were nine sultans in Malaya. Were there power struggles or perhaps territorial disputes that happened often prior to that?
Not every state is a utopia state. Of course, there are some power struggles from within the royal families. But I think the last bloodied power struggle was in the previous century. And after that, there was not much until the Japanese came and changed a few things, rearranged the furniture and more or less rearranging the who should be sultan.
They often stuck to the affairs of their own states, but it was the involvement of the British and the introduction of the controversial Malaysian Union that spurred things into motion.
And one thing led to another, and suddenly the sultans were shoved papers under their nose, and it was supposed to be what they called the Malayan Union. And the Malayan Union more or less took the powers away from these sultans, and the only thing that was given to them was to be the head of the Islamic ruling in their respective states. So more or less, they were acting like state muftis. So they signed, and not knowing what they went into, until some of the Malay nationalists, like Tunku Abdul Rahman, Dato' On Jaafar, said, hey, what's going on here? You better not sign this. But they said, we already signed it. So they fought. They fought for the rights of the Sultan back from the British, and they held street protests from Perlis to the south. There was a lot of protests. The citizens of the various states went to the streets and protest that their sultan was no longer in power. And they did not like the idea of a Malayan Union.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us back to the Malayan Union and the reactions after the sultans have signed off their power. So what exactly did Tunku Abdul Rahman and the rest of the UMNO delegations, what were the rest of the Malay nationalists angry about?
The Malays were very loyal to their sultans. So that was the crux of the whole thing. So when they are loyal to somebody and that somebody has no more power, And what's the point? So there's a need for them to restore the powers of the person they are loyal to. So that's why, you know, they were not happy. And the British had the final say in everything.
Mainly the Malays felt a very strong connection to the Sultans, obviously. But also at the same time, the British colonists brought in individuals and groups from India, groups from China. And I think the question of assimilation and the question of connecting to the local leaders and local ruler also bring into question, right? How exactly did these new immigrants feel at that time having to be under the patronage of the king?
Well, the Chinese and the Indians, they've been here for centuries, especially during trade. So I think what you meant was the British brought the coolies and the laborers.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
Okay. Yes.
If that's what you're talking about, they don't have much of a say then. And citizenship was not a big issue. And at that time, the rest of the world, you know, they were just looking at citizenship models and all that. So we started to define boundaries and having this legal rights called citizens. So it's still new. And when you travel from one place to the other, there was no such thing as passport. You just have papers and the right to travel. So there was not much dissatisfaction from these groups because they were already working and they were more concerned with their economics rather than their legal standing.
Battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan.
After World War II, the protests by the Malay community and UMNO were far too much for the British to handle. The empire was already weakened, strained, and though they won the war, the aftermath was too much to bear for the Brits. Overstretched resources and manpower, destroyed infrastructure, and bankruptcy. Letting go was perhaps the most viable and realistic option.
The idea of an independence Malaya is actually a federation of all these Malay states plus the three straight settlements. Or if you take out Singapore, it's two straight settlements, Penang and Malacca. So the original idea of a Malayan union would have forced this new body, Federation of Malaya, to be a republic with no royal institution at all. And it did not go down well among the people because they're so used to having a royalty up at the top. So among the sultans of nine states, they decided that we should be represented. So that's where the idea of an agong was born. But then the question is, who should be the first one? And should it be a permanent seat where the next one is passed down through the sons and, you know, like in a normal royal succession. So they had to think about it. And when they got together, they said, okay, we'll do a rotation and everybody would have a chance to become the head of this new country.
Bila satu pergi, yang lain mesti bersedia menjalankan kerja supaya pemerintahan negeri tidak tergendala. Yang demikian, di Istana Negara, dalam satu istiadat yang ringkas, yang di-Pertuan Agong Persekutuan dan Perdana Menteri yang pertama, masing-masing telah mengangkat sumpah jawatan akan berkhidmat kepada rakyat dan negara.
So what exactly were the characteristics or maybe the requirements that one had to have before they could be, say, elected into the role of an Agong?
Well, first of all, you have to be the Sultan of your state, of course, obviously. And if you happen to be a Sultan, but if you happen to be, let's say, 10 years old, well, they'll disqualify you. You're a minor, so I don't think they want you to be the agong. So there are rules on what qualifies to be an agong. So they sat down together and sorted this thing out.
And what exactly were the qualifications that an agong needed?
First of all, you have to be liked by the rest of the sultans. So the first thing to do is to elect one from within themselves. From nine, you just elect one, and that should be the agong. And then they give you only 5 years. After that, it has to go to the next one. And it goes on and on and on. And the agong has to be at least an adult. So it was just simple qualifications only. You have to be elected or liked, and you have to be an adult.
Maybe you can tell us what goes on in the room. So I can imagine 9 sultans in one room with representatives standing or sitting beside them, helping them in the process. So what exactly happens in that room?
The first time around, they had this 9 heads from the different states. And there is no nomination. Okay, I select the Sultan of Pahang, and then somebody would say, I second that. No, there's no such thing as that. What they did was, okay, let's not go through that process. And what we do is, we'll take the most senior. Senior meaning, if you've been in as the Sultan the longest, you'll be the first one to be considered. And then the next most senior, and the third one, and four. And it goes down the list, right?
So there's a pecking order.
There's a pecking order, yeah. So what happened on the first time around is that the most junior of the lot would be the one taking the votes down or counting the votes. Huh?
To add to the mystique of royal ceremonies like these, all the Malay rulers were required to write their ballots with the same pen that they passed around the table.
The first one came up, and the eldest one was at that time Sultan Ibrahim of Johor. But he already stated earlier that he was too old. He was about 82 then. And he said, no, I don't want to be, the king of Malaya. And then it was, the second most was Sultan of Pahang, Sultan Abu Bakar. So he was the most senior. So what the most junior did was to take the first Sultan and say, okay, Sultan Abu Bakar will be the Agong. Yes or no? And they will just mark yes or no. And then he'll go to the next Sultan, ask him the same question. And that's all they have to do. There's no nomination, there's nothing else, just yes or no. So by the time the junior Sultan went around, and there was more no's than yes for the Sultan of Pahang.
Oh, why is that?
It's not recorded in history, but rumors has it that he had too many wives.
Oh, so that become an issue as well.
I don't know.
Well, you had to be liked by the rest of the council.
It's just a rumor. Huh? Oh, I'm not saying it, but that's a rumor. So they tried the second time around. Okay, we won't go to the next senior. We'll stick to him. Maybe somebody will change your mind and we'll go again. The second round, there was more no's than yes. So it went on 5 times. And then somebody finally said, okay, that's enough. Let's go to the next Sultan. So the next up was Tuanku Abdul Rahman from Negeri Sembilan. So the junior Sultan went around and he did his duty and he counted. There was 8 yes to 1 no. And it's required that as long as there's a simple majority, you're the Agong. That's how Tuanku Abdul Rahman got to become the first Agong.
And the rest is history. Tuanku Abdul Rahman from Negeri Sembilan became our first young Dipituan Agong. He was installed into office on early August 1957. You've been listening to Razak Baharom from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club, who has been speaking to us about the installment of Malaya's first king. Later when we come back, we'll explore a new Malaya and how the young Dipituan Agong fit into this new vision of the uncharted future. All that in a minute when Malaysiana continues. BFM 89.9.
Best for money. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, I'm Azif Fazuddin and this is Malaysiana.
Mengikut adat turun-temurun, Raja-Raja Melayu tidak pernah dimahkotakan. Jadi diadakanlah satu cara pertabalan yang ringkas mengikut kebesaran adat istiadat lama. Di hadapan duli-duli yang maha mulia Raja-Raja Melayu, Duke dan Duchess of Gloucester, pembesar-pembesar dan zef-zef dari negeri asing, dengan iringan paluan nobat, Yang di-Pertuan Agong yang pertama, Duli Yang Maha Mulia Sri Paduka Baginda Tuanku Abdul Rahman dan Raja Permaisuri Agong berangkat ke Dewan Singgasana.
Earlier when you left us, we explored the road leading to the installment of Malaysia's first Yang di-Pertuan Agong. Selected among themselves, the appointment rested on seniority and likability. As it turns out, our first Yang di-Pertuan Agong was Tuanku Abdul Rahman from Negeri Sembilan, who coincidentally shared the same name as Malaysia's first Prime Minister, Tunku Abdul Rahman.
Tuanku Abdul Rahman from Negeri Sembilan. His relative, Tunku Abdul Rahman, the Prime Minister actually did not prefer him to be the Agong.
Why is that?
Because Tuanku Abdul Rahman of Negeri Sembilan was a known Japanese sympathizer during the war. They were digging skeletons out of the closet and they found this, you know, piece of information. They didn't like it. So they were thinking that maybe it could lead to a scandal. They were checking everything, you know, basically. But in the end, Tuanku Abdul Rahman turned out to be a super nice guy. Until now, we all carry him or his image in our pockets everywhere we go.
That's right, the ringgit.
Yes. So that's how, you know, he is portrayed as our first Agong, and that's who he is, irrespective of what people say before that.
We have Tuanku Abdul Rahman as our first Agong. Would the role of an Agong and a Sultan differ?
Yeah, the Agong is more of a ceremonial head of state where he will act upon the recommendations of the Prime Minister and his government. So that's the role of the Agong. But the Sultans, also based on each respective state constitution, will also have their own set of powers, depending on the states.
So now we have Tuanku Abdul Rahman, who is our first Agong. Maybe you could walk us through the inauguration. What were the preparations that had to be made? What were perhaps the conflicts or the stories that came before and when he was walking up to the throne?
Each respective states have their own royal ceremonies, and no two are alike. For instance, Kedah would have music in the background, you know, by the Nobat, and they have their own regalias, you know, their own set of kris. Some of them got two kris, some got three, and the costume they wear, they're all different too. For instance, like Johor, they don't have a tanjak. What they have is a military cap. So you'll never see a Sultan of Johor wearing a tanja, you know, because it doesn't exist. And he doesn't even wear a royal costume. He has a military outfit. So the question is, okay, we're going to install our first Agong, and on whose tradition? The new royal institution had a headache. What shall we do? Okay, there's a question of the tanja, there's a question of the costume, there's a question of the regalias, and then the question of how do we address this new guy? The first suggestion was not even Agong. It was Yang di-Pertuan Besar. So they were thinking and they said, hey, that's too close to Negeri Sembilan, you know. We should have something different. That's when they had that new title, Yang di-Pertuan Agong. The salutation has to be correct or has to be formed. And then there's the case of the tanjak. So they sat around again and then some guy said, since Negeri Sembilan is the first Agong, why don't he use his own royal costume? So the first Agong from Negeri Sembilan had his own tengkolo.
Tengkolo being the headgear that you wear.
That's correct, yeah. And there's a name for it, huh? And it's called Dendam Tak Sudah.
Quite a sharp name, I must say.
Yeah, it's Perpetual Revenge.
Perpetual Revenge, that's right.
Apparently, the story goes back into the Negeri Sembilan courts, where I think one of the Yang di-Pertuan Besar over there married a foreigner, and people didn't like it. They wanted him to marry another local royal. So there was some revenge somewhere being taken place. That's how that tengkolo became Dendam Tak Sudah. Now, the first Agong is going to be using his own royal regalia. So they say that if Perak is next, then Perak would have his own regalia. And then, what about music? So the Nobat in Malaysia, there's only four states with Nobat. That's Perak, Kedah, Selangor and Terengganu. The rest don't have it.
So what's the substitutes for these states that don't have Nobat?
So they'll ask the Agong, which states do you want to choose your Nobat from? The first one, I think, chose Kedah. So Kedah music was being played while he was being installed. So the next most important symbol for the royal institution is the ever-encompassing kris. Kris, as you know, is a symbol of manliness. So they say we can't just ask somebody to just customize a kris and call it the Malayan kris with no tradition at all. And you don't want the agung to, you know, hold the kris up and somebody say, hey, that was made by so and so and so. So we don't want that. We want tradition. Eh? So they said every state contribute a kris. Johor contributed one, Negeri Sembilan contributed one, Pahang, Terengganu, and all the states contributed one. And so what they did was they took all this kris and they melted it. They melted it and fashioned a new one. The kris that we have, that Malaysia or the Agong would carry, there's two kris. Eh? One is kris Panjang Diraja and the other one is kris Pendek Diraja. So it's the Pendek that was a fusion of all the other kris. It has built-in history already from all the different states.
Interesting. And where did the long kris come from?
Well, the long kris was customized.
Customized. But yeah, the one which is steeped in tradition, even in its iron, is the shorter one.
The shorter one, yeah. So the Agong would be carrying two kris.
So the role of the Agong is incredibly steeped with symbols, right? And I imagine that even in the ceremony itself, what was symbolic about the very first inauguration ceremony?
Of course, they'll have the swearing-in and the pledge of being an Agong, being the king to the new nation. But he is not Agong until all the ceremony has been taking place. And finally, he'll take up his kris and give it a kiss. As soon as he gives it a kiss, that is when he's the Agong.
Petabalan yang berlapik di atas kain sutra kuning adalah dimasyhurkan dan dimaklumkan kepada sekalian warga negara serta isi negeri persekutuan tanah Melayu bahawa Tuanku Abdul Rahman.
The king was installed into office on early August 1957 at the heels of the Malayan independence. Unfortunately, he was not king for long.
He died. He passed away in 1960, 2 years after he was holding the office of Agong. There's another thing that when we pass the reign of Agong to the next Agong, again, there is no blood relationship with the next guy. So they have to go through the election process again. So if you look at the chronology of all our Agongs, you'll see gaps in between Agongs. But the gaps is filled by the deputy or the acting Agong, whoever was his deputy took over. Huh? So he became more or less the acting Agong. After Tuanku Abdul Rahman passed away, the next Sultan they chose was from Selangor, Tuanku Ishamuddin Alam Shah. We know him by the later capital of Selangor, which is Shah Alam, was named after him. Tuanku Ishamuddin, he was elected as the next Agong. So, okay, they were getting ready to install him. So they went through all the motion. And the day that he was to be installed, he died in his bed on the day he was supposed to be installed. So technically, he is not the Agong yet.
But he passed away in his bed.
But he passed away in his bed in his full outfit, getting ready to be installed. So they were thinking, should we consider him as a second Agong? Or should we ignore that? So they decided that, okay, he should be given the full state recognition as an Agong. He was the Agong that was not installed, but is an Agong. I told you, when you kiss the kris, you become the Agong. So he didn't have that chance to kiss the kris. So they had to do another round of selecting the next Agong. So this time they decided to have the Raja of Perlis, Tuanku Said Putra, as the third Agong.
In the end, Raja Said Putra from Perlis was chosen. He was 40 when he was appointed the third Yang Dipertuan Agong. For all the rigor of tradition and ceremonies, the new Agong did bring with him something new.
Tuanku Said Putra was the first Agong to wear that black Agong outfit. If you look at any official pictures of any Agong, you'll see they're wearing black. So he's the first Agong to be wearing that outfit. Eh? And it's called Muscat. And it was designed by Tengku Abdul Rahman himself.
Where did that tradition come from?
It came from his mind, I suppose.
So it was created?
It was created. It's called Muscat because it looks similar to the country Oman's outfit. If you were to Google Oman's Sultan and look at our Sultan, more or less the same, the outfit. Eh? That's why it's called Muscat, the capital of Oman. So Tengku Abdul Rahman liked that outfit that he wanted to adopt it for our Agong to wear it, you know. And he managed to convince the Royal Institution for the Agong to be wearing that from then on. It's wool, it's black wool embroidered with gold threads. But you can see the Bunga Raya motifs and a few other federal motifs on the outfit.
Now, we've walked through three different Agongs and understand that it's been 58 years. Yes, that's right.
Okay.
It's been 58 years since independence. In fact, 58 years since we first brought in our new Agong, or the first Agong, right? What has changed in these 58 years, at least in regards to the Agong, in its role, in its symbolism, in its power?
Speaking of power, if the Agong were to commit a crime, he can be tried.
And I understand that one came. That one probably came during the Mahathir administration.
No,
even before that.
Even before that, yeah. It was originally that I think they forgot to write about the immunity of the Agong.
Ah, okay.
I mean, he does have special powers, okay. But when it comes to crime, it's a different ball game altogether.
I see. Mm-hmm. So is the change in power perhaps one of the only changes that happened in this period of 58 years since? Or are there also other changes, perhaps in symbol?
There's not much. The Agong is a constitutional head, and he will be making a decision based on the advice of the Prime Minister and his government. So that has not changed.
Long live the king.
Dengan seruan daulat tuanku, bunyi bedilan meriam, paluan nobat dan bacaan doa selamat, sempurnalah istiadat pertabalan yang di-Pertuan Agong yang pertama.
That was Azif Azuddin in conversation with Razak Bahrom from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club. If you missed the full interview, download the podcast at www.bfm.my. Join us next Sunday when we talk to Haji Muhammad Sarif Kalam, the first Malaysian to raise the national flag during the Merdeka Declaration in 1957. You've been listening to Malaysiana with me, Nadia Aziz, on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.